when you're a journalist and people don't trust you, it's always your fault.
These people need to be represented. They are Canadian. They deserve to have a voice and a seat at the table.
It is time to go back to the office, and the time is now.
Russia had reasons to be concerned. They had reasons to be fearful.
We're at an absolute turning point in reproduction.
This is the problem with realism. They just treat all countries the same. They don't distinguish between dictatorships and democracies.
Hello, Monk listeners. Rudyard Griffiths here, your host and moderator. Welcome to this, our continuing conversations called the Monk Dialogues. These are in-depth Q&As with some of the world's sharpest minds and brightest thinkers. We go deep into the big issues and ideas that are transforming our world and shaping our future on each and every Monk Dialogue. Well, protests in Israel have reached a fever pitch. Departing flights from Ben-Gurion Airport have recently been halted. Military reservists in the hundreds are refusing to serve. A defense minister has been fired, and a prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has placed a hold, a temporary halt, on his controversial series of judicial reforms, all largely because Israel is now experiencing some of the biggest mass demonstrations in its history. Over 500,000 people taking to the streets in cities around the country to oppose Netanyahu's constitutional reforms. Where does this all go? What is the future trajectory of an Israeli society being pulled apart by sharp divisions on issues of religion, ideology, and the very notion of what is a Jewish state? Perhaps no one understands the dynamics of this moment in Israel better than Michael Oren. He's the former Israeli ambassador to the United States, an internationally renowned scholar and author, and a former politician in the Knesset. Michael joined me for an in-depth conversation about what's going on the ground in Israel with the protests, the different political factions that are vying for control and fighting in and through this debate over Israeli constitutional reform. Our conversation also includes some far-reaching thinking about what this all means for the future of Israel as a democratic, free, and open society. Michael Oren, welcome to the Monk Dialogues.
I'm delighted to be here. How are you?
You're someone who's had a career that spans Israeli politics, diplomacy, military service. But I want to begin with you where I first discovered Michael Oren, and that was as an award-winning historian. If you could help me and our listeners try to situate what we're seeing in Israel right now in the context of the country's history. Is there a moment in Israel's past that you think could be somehow an analogy, a reverberation, a mirror to understand what's happening today? Or should we instead be seeing this constitutional crisis as something new and potentially dangerous that's emerged in Israel's political, civic, and constitutional culture? Give us your sense of that. That's where I want to begin this conversation with you.
Well, like as most historic events, and this is indeed an event of massive historic import for the state of Israel, there is continuity and there is innovation. So the continuity here, the antecedents to the crisis go back to the foundation of the state of Israel, the decision by our founding father, David Ben-Gurion, and other founding mothers around him and fathers, Golda Meir, Moshe Dayan, that generation, to determine not to have a constitution. The constitution was too difficult, especially when Israel was under fire, a highly diverse population. It wasn't like the population of the United States in 1789, was largely white and Christian, and very, very diverse. And so we decided to adopt the British system of basic laws, which together would form something like a constitution, but it actually left our Supreme Court bereft of a constitutional base for making judgments. And the only base they had was this notion of reasonableness, which is highly subjective, because what is reasonable to the Supreme Court may not be reasonable to a lot of other people. We also designed a system of government in which there were only two branches of government. The United States has three, the executive, the judiciary, and the judiciary and executive. We only have the judiciary and the executive and the legislature, which are the same. The Knesset is a branch of the branch of the government. It's an expression of the government. Prime Minister Netanyahu, when he goes into the Knesset, is not Prime Minister Netanyahu. He's a member of Knesset. Netanyahu. And so when you weaken one of these branches of government, then you no longer have effective checks on decision making. So to understand that, you understand why when this government is trying to basically gut the Supreme Court of much of its authority and weakening that check, then you can have a government that could pass all types of legislation. It could, for example, outlaw homosexuality. A lot of people in this government are very, very religious, are not typically partial to LGBT people. You could take all sorts of measures against the Palestinians, all sorts of measures against free speech or freedom of assembly, and there'd be no Supreme Court to override it. And so this would profoundly alter the nature of Israeli society, which is why so many hundreds of thousands of Israelis are out protesting. So that's, you know, that's continuity. What is new here? What is new here is the immensely moving and impressive outpouring of love for this country by its citizens. I honestly haven't seen anything like this. I know you'll say that I don't look this old, but I'm that old. And I participated in, I marched against the Vietnam War in the 60s and the 70s. And we burnt the American flag. We talked about America spelled with a K, and we cursed the U.S. military, and the policemen were pigs. I just came from a demonstration of close to 500,000 people in Tel Aviv, where everyone was singing, "We love the army, we love the police." Everyone's carrying an Israeli flag, and everyone's standing at attention when we sang the national anthem, Hatikva. Can you imagine 1960 standing at attention to sing the Star Spangled Banner after a march on Washington? Like, it was never going to happen. I just have never seen anything like it. I think the closest thing you could find in history generally would be some of the Velvet Revolutions against Soviet communism in 1989, 90. But it's profoundly moving. Now, having said all that, it's also profoundly disturbing because we don't know how this is going to come out. Yes, there may be 500,000 or even 700,000 people out protesting, but about 2 million people voted for this government. And the charges on the right now is that some ministers are buckling to what amounts to a putsch, a revolution from the street. And they'll remind the government that when previous governments who were more centrist or leftist took actions that were against the right wing, such as withdrawing from the Gaza Strip in 2005 and ripping up 21 settlements, tearing 9,000 Israelis out of their homes. I was there as a reserve officer. It was very traumatic. Nobody on the right said we're leaving the country. Nobody on the right said we're not going to serve in the army anymore. So who are the real patriots here? Who are the real Zionists? And on top of all of this, there is the schism here is not only about the interpretation of democracy, whether the Supreme Court should have what we call judicial review or not judicial review. But it goes to very deep divisions in Israeli society between people from Western backgrounds known as the Ashkenazim, people from the Eastern backgrounds, the Mizrachim, between religious and secular, between working class and high tech. Now, I'm talking to you from South Tel Aviv. My neighborhood is a working class, largely Mizrachi neighborhood. And they see this not as a fight over democracy and liberty and, you know, checks and balances. They see this as a basically white elite upper class that refuses to relinquish power to the working people and who win at the polls. And they see it very differently. And matter of fact, there was a big poster up on our major highway. People put up posters on the highway, a billboard, quoting the president of the Supreme Court back in the 90s, Aaron Barak, who was really the architect of the judicial overreach approach that has so antagonized parts of Israeli society. They have him quoted saying, "I cannot find a Moroccan who's qualified to be on the bench." That is a Moroccan Jew who's qualified to be on the bench, quote. Now, it's the people who are protesting will say that the government is playing the race card. And it's difficult for me living in this neighborhood to see who's being played and who isn't, but I talk to my neighbors and this is the way they feel.
You previously served as Israel's ambassador in the United States. As you say, you were previously an American citizen. You renounced your citizenship in your adult years. So you have a deep familiarity with American culture. And I wonder if that could help us, or maybe not, try to understand this moment that Israel is in, because we are all familiar, I think, of the idea of an America that is polarized, divided, separated on the issues of class, but also on these issues of identity. Is that an analog or a kind of lens to understand where Israel is today and why this debate around the Supreme Court has just become so explosive, so incendiary for all the different sides of Israeli society, that Israel today is profoundly divided?
Well, there are analogies, but they're almost like reverse analogies. We're a mirror image of the United States. You can say that part of the GOP, the Republican Party, is led by an individual who is very educated, would say very white, very rich, and yet he taken is representing the working people, the poor people who are uneducated, don't have a college education. In this country, we have an individual who is comes from the upper class, MIT graduate, very wealthy, Benjamin Netanyahu. He has a house in the wealthiest community in Israel, in Caesarea. And he is the champion of the working class. Though in the United States, it's the white working class who is attracted to Trump. And here it's the Mizrahi Eastern working class who's attracted to Netanyahu. In the United States, it's the left that has the problem with the Supreme Court. In this country, it's the right that has the problem with the Supreme Court. It's like a mirror image. And it's interesting, when I can't help but look at, say, an entity like the New York Times, which has been hypercritical of this government and hyper-supportive of the protesters. You could say that the New York Times comes from the same echelon of society that the protesters do. It's almost like there's a way you could look at this and say, this is kind of class unity, isn't it? Hyper-educated, you know, upper class, privileged people. And yet, so there are parallels, but there are also sort of cross listings. You know, we're sort of kitty corner from the United States in many of these issues. But the fact of the matter is, what is most reflective is the division itself. That societies today have a hard time cohering, and that polarization has come to characterize many societies. I see what's happening in France today, and people are burning the French flag, and they're not exactly singing the Marseillaise when they're out protesting against Macron. So we have that. We have the advantage of love, and maybe that sounds a bit, you know, mawkish, but I'm very moved by the display of love.
Fascinating. Let's zero in a little bit on the actual controversy itself, because I'm recording this podcast from Canada. Canada has featured in the political rhetoric around the debate of the reform of your court. Our Supreme Court justices are appointed by whoever our sitting prime minister is. In effect, we have direct appointment, direct political appointment. Our judiciary really has, you know, very tacit, informal say, if any, over these important appointments. Why is this, you've talked a little bit already, but let's go deeper here. Why is it not right to equate, let's say, the Canadian and American system of judicial appointment with what the Netanyahu government is recommending here, is proposing in this legislation?
See, I'm not objective on this. I actually have a book coming out this week called Israel 2048, The Rejuvenated State. It's a vision of Israel on our 100th birthday, what the state should look like. And it's from every angle. It's educational policy and social policy, labor policy, Israel Arabs, Israel Palestinians, Israel diaspora Jews, everybody. But there's a chapter in there on the need for judicial reform, particularly the reform of the Supreme Court. I wrote this 3 years ago. So this notion that we have to have reform the Supreme Court has been around for a long time. And here's the basic reason why. You know, I don't know about Canada, but certainly in the United States, if you're a citizen of the United States, you have not one but two opportunities to influence the composition of your Supreme Court. You vote for the president and you vote for the Senate. In this country, we have almost no say on the composition of the Supreme Court. Supreme Court judges are chosen overwhelmingly by sitting Supreme Court judges and other jurists. And quite naturally, they're human beings. They're going to choose someone who agrees with them. So in terms of its worldview, the Supreme Court of Israel has basically marched in place since 1992. Hasn't really moved, but Israeli public opinion has moved. It's moved very far to the right because of profound disagreements over the peace process. Every time we withdraw from territory, we don't get peace, we get rockets. So that impacts voters, particularly young voters. And we have also the largest under 30 voting population per capita in the world. That has a tremendous impact. The Supreme Court's moved, the Knesset's moved rightward. So you've got this widening gap in worldviews between the Supreme Court and the Knesset. And increasingly, the Supreme Court was turning down pieces of legislation that were passed by the Knesset. The people in the Knesset were saying, hey, who elected you? No one elected you. We're the elected people. We're the sovereigns. And there was talk already 3, 4, 5 years ago of creating an override law, which means the Knesset would vote to override the Supreme Court's override of any pieces of legislation. Now, to make matters even worse, if that's not bad, that worse enough, A, we don't have a constitution, okay? And so remember, we talked about this reasonableness notion. And then the court was extremely activist. That same Aaron Barak, who appears on that that racist poster, it's a poster that's where he's being portrayed as racist, who said that everything is adjudicable. The Supreme Court has no boundaries. So the Supreme Court could tell me, you know, where this computer is on my desk. The Supreme Court could tell me where the lighting is above me. Everything could be determined by the Supreme Court. And they did it. They're all over the place. They were telling the Israeli government, you know, where they could put security barriers and overriding the army. And so you combine all of that fact, the fact that the Supreme Court is marching in place in terms of its worldview, and it doesn't have a constitution to base its decisions on, but only this notion of reasonableness, highly subjective notion of reasonableness, and arrogates to itself powers that are not enjoyed by any Supreme Court in the world. You put that all together and you've got yourself a formula for what's going out in the street right now. Now that is very much distinct from Canada. I don't think the Canadian Supreme Court, the way I know it, arrogates itself that type of scope where it can determine everything. It does not. It has input from the political echelon, of course, and people can, you have a feeling as a Canadian citizen that you are impacting in one way or the other your composition of your Supreme Court, and you probably have a firmer set of laws on which to base. Which the Supreme Court can base its decisions. You have one other thing that we don't have, and you have one major, major division, okay, between the Francophonic population and the Anglophonic population, and I understand that, but we have divisions up, down, and around, okay? 21% of the population is Arab, but even in that, there are divisions between Druze and Circassians and Bedouins and Arabs from different places, Christian Arabs, Muslim Arabs, very different. And religious Jews, secular Jews, as we said, Eastern, Western Jews, far more fractious as a society. And we do not have an 800-year-long tradition of civility. Now, you can trace your democratic system to the Magna Carta of the 13th century. The vast majority of people who are in this country either came from the Middle East or from Eastern Europe. None of them came with democracies in their suitcases. Democracy is an alien idea. Yeah, we talk about Israel being the only democracy in the Middle East. There's a reason for that. This is not the wellspring of democracy here. And it's an alien notion to this region. And so we had to sort of create democracy from scratch. And we don't, while we may have democratic institutions and democratic norms, we don't necessarily have a deep democratic tradition or culture. And so what we're missing often is civility. You have a certain amount of civility in Canada, at least you used to have, that that acts as a type of check in itself. There, the notion that there are things that are not done. And that we don't have.
Hey, Monk Podcast listeners, I wanted to let you know about our other weekly audio program. It's called Friday Focus. And hey, guess what? It comes out each and every Friday. It's half an hour long, and it provides you with a masterclass on international events, all the big issues and ideas shaping our world. We've got that for you each and every Friday here at the Monk Debate. Simply access via our website, www.monkdebates.com. Click on Friday Focus in the top right navigation. You'll get all the details. or check out a sample of the program in the same podcast feed as the main Monk Debates podcast. I hope you'll join us for the next edition of the Friday Focus podcast. Now back to our program. Well, let's hypothesize about what could happen in the near term. It certainly looks as if Netanyahu's coalition has been shaken in the last few days. You've had the firing of the defense minister, rumblings from other key cabinet ministers and figures in his coalition government. You know that this coalition is a small one, a majority of just a few seats. You've also sat in the Knesset. You know Israeli politics like few others. What do you think is likely here? Will Netanyahu eventually be forced to walk back this ambitious slate of judicial reforms? Is that the most likely outcome if he wants to save his government and save his coalition?
Well, the coalition is pulling the other way. Most of the members of the coalition are saying to not back down. He has several members of his own Likud party who are whispering that we have to back down, including Nir Barkat, the former mayor of Jerusalem. We've had now Yoav Gallant come out, the defense minister, now former defense minister, who was fired last night, and Yuli Edelstein. And it's interesting, I just say, you know, parenthetically, I've had close relationships with all three individuals. Nir Barkat was with me in the siege of Beirut in 1982. He actually was my direct commander, very fine commander. Yoav Gallant was with me in Knesset. He was in my party for 4 years. I know him very well. And Yuli Edelstein was my first contact in the Soviet Union when I was sent to underground to work with Soviet refuseniks at the time. He was a very brave individual. So I know them quite well. And Israel has really been focusing on them as being sort of the adults in the room and the Likud party to come out and say something. What happened was that when Yoav Gallant came out, Bibi immediately put his head on a spike, and these other prospective opponents of the reform within the Likud party quickly backed down. Many people don't know that the Likud is not a party. The Likud is a family. You're born into the Likud. You ask people when they joined the Likud. Well, on the eighth day, I joined the Likud. You don't betray the family. Especially when the family's down. And it's interesting that Yoav Gallant, neither Yoav Gallant nor Nir Barkat actually came from the Likud. They joined the Likud later on in their careers. So they actually weren't born into the family. They were, I don't know, they're Likudniks by marriage, put it that way. So they already have a bit of an asterisk over their heads. I think that Netanyahu, being a very, very clever politician, will do a tactical retreat. Tonight he's supposed to go on television. He's supposed to announce that he'll delay the passage of the legislation until after the holidays. We're about to enter into about a month of holidays, which includes the Passover holidays. It's also our Independence Day, our Memorial Day, and Holocaust Remembrance Day, which basically shuts down the country for a month, but also the Knesset goes on recess. And I think Netanyahu's probably thinking, okay, I'll gain a month. I will regroup. Some of the tempers will begin to calm down around here, and we'll come back in the spring, and people will be more interested in going to the beach, and they will be protesting on the middle of the street. It is a huge roll of the dice, a huge roll of the dice. Whether succeed, I don't know. If there's anything I've learned in politics, is that it's always premature to eulogize Mr. Netanyahu. Always premature. Every time we get into a crisis like this, people say, this is it. This is the end of Bibi. And I always say, wait a minute, not so fast. You know, if you remember the movie Fatal Attraction, where the hand comes out of the dirt, that's Bibi. You think he's gone, and he's got you by the throat. That is Bibi. It's interesting, if I can go on, if I can riff just for a second, that Israeli politics generally, for the last 20 years at least, have been about two words. They've been about Benjamin Netanyahu. And why is that? This man is, and I've worked with him for many years. And he has a resume that's, you know, non-parile. He's not only a former commando, he was a commander of the commandos. He was a decorated veteran. He is a graduate of MIT. He's an economist, a world-class economist. He is a former ambassador. He has held every position in Israeli governance, serious position. He's the most experienced parliamentarian in Israel, maybe in the world, maybe outside of Joe Biden. And he's been around for over 40 years. And And he is not only the longest serving Israeli prime minister, he's the longest serving democratically elected leader in the world. Physically robust, brilliant, a great, one of the great orators of our century. It's a difficult act to follow, but there's the but. And there's a big but. And he's got three charges of corruption against him that he's defending himself against. And that's the beginning of the, just the top of the complaints that people have about his style of government. Most people who have worked with him are alienated from him or hostile to him. I mean, I managed to work with him in not those years and not leave under those terms, but most people have. And then why does he keep on getting elected? Why this man? And the answer can be found on YouTube. If you type in your YouTube browser, type in BB Sitter, and you'll get a political ad that was in the 2015 campaign, 30 seconds long. And what you see is some nerdy parents sitting, getting ready to go out. You hear kids in the background scream, and then the doorbell rings, and father answers the door, and it's Netanyahu. And the father says, "What are you doing here?" And Netanyahu says, "Well, you asked for a BB Sitter." And, "Well, we don't want you," the father says. "Well, I'll bring Sippy." Sippy meaning Sippy Livni. "No, no, we don't want Sippy Livni." He says, "Okay, I'll bring you here." "We don't want you here, you're Pete." And the father finally says, "Okay, come in." Next scene, BB sitting on the couch, eating popcorn, watching TV. The father comes in, the parents come in. They says, "Everything okay?" And BB says, "Yes, your children are sleeping safely." That's all you need to know about Israeli politics for the last 20 years. Your children are sleeping safe. It's the BB Sitter. And you ask, even people who hate him will say that he is the most qualified to be prime minister. Very difficult act to follow. The Likud without Bibi, Likud with Bibi polls at about 28 to 30 seats. Without Bibi, it'll go down to 10 seats.
But Michael, we have many, you're familiar with them, that large numbers, upwards of 200, senior reservists inside the Israeli Air Force are indicating that they are not going to be showing up for regular training, to the point where there's speculation that if this continues much further, it could actually, materially impact Israel's security and defense readiness. So to what extent is that, a lever here, a huge source of pressure on Netanyahu and this coalition? Because that seems antithetical to the BB Sitter analogy, that this debate now is embroiling more than just the Constitution, more than just people's sense of their own individual rights and dignity as citizens. It is impinging Israeli security.
No question about it. And that, to me, is almost more a forceful argument than the actual reform. And I just have an article that came out in the Times of Israel a couple of hours ago, where I look at the history of Israel putting money in what I call its bank, its diplomatic bank. So if you make gestures for peace and you show that you're serious about reaching an accord with Arab enemies, then when Israel goes to war, we can draw on that credit. And for example, in 1948, in our War of Independence, we accepted the UN partition resolution. The Arabs rejected it. And so we were able to win that war and push our borders out much more without the world criticizing us, because we had made that gesture of accepting the UN resolution. And I go through the whole history over the last 70 years, when prime ministers have made that, and governments have made that gesture, how then when we had to fight, the world gave us a lot more leeway, time and space to fight, because we had shown we really wanted peace, and we were forced to go to war. And what I say at the end of this article is that basically we're dealing with an empty bank account now. We're in overdraft, because we have ministers who not only want to gut Israel's democratic institutions, but they also have ministers who have talked about denying the existence of the Palestinian people, ministers who talk about destroying a Palestinian village, and certainly rejecting any American suggestions on the peace process. America's our ultimate ally. So if we have to go to war, and I fear that a large-scale conflict is very possible in the not-too-distant future, and I can go into that why, we will be with an empty bank account. We'll actually be in arrears, and that will have an immediate ability, that will immediately impact on our ability to defend ourselves. And so, yes, the situation acutely impacts Israel's security. And it's not just soldiers who refuse to serve. It's our entire, you know, geostrategic envelope, which is being shredded and extremely dangerous for us. And if I could be very specific, tomorrow we may have to go to war to prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And when we do, Iran's allies in the region, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria, the Houthi rebels in Yemen, they're going to start firing rockets at us, thousands and thousands of rockets. We're going to have to defend ourselves. We're going to need ammunition from the United States, and we're going to need diplomatic cover in the UN. But if we have alienated this administration, if we have alienated other allies in the world, we're going to be pretty much on our own.
Let's just talk for a moment about Iran. To what extent are you worried that this crisis is emboldening Tehran? That if they're sitting there looking at Israel right now, their opponent is divided. Their society is in chaos. I mean, Michael, you know, you're an astute scholar of Middle Eastern power dynamics. Does this suggest to you a kind of pre-sequel to the potential here for a bigger conflict between Israel and its neighbors if this remains unresolved?
No question about it. That, to me, if you ask me, that's my deepest fear you've touched on, Roger, and that's this. We've already seen indications of it. Just last week, Hezbollah sent a bomber into northern Israel, planted a bomb at a major intersection. The terrorist was killed, but they're probing us. They're probing us. 2 weeks ago, the Iranians signed a reconciliation with Saudi Arabia with the intervention of China. It was Chinese mediation. And everyone was very quick to point out the fact that the Chinese have now sort of ousted the United States from that mediator role in the Middle East. But what they didn't say was Israel's role in this. The Saudis were looking to us to defend them from nuclearizing Iran. And the Saudis are looking over what's happening in Israel now and say, listen, can't depend on these guys. These guys are sitting there tearing themselves apart over reform of the Supreme Court. Meanwhile, Iran is rushing to nuclear capacity, threshold capacity. One estimate from the United States that they're about 2 weeks away from having enough fissile material to make a nuclear weapon. And what are we doing? What is Israel doing? So, yes, very, very deep concern. And I'm not unconvinced that Iran will take advantage of the situation to move within a hair's breadth of actual nuclear weapons acquisition, and may make the decision to break out and create one. May, but we are not in a position, I can see, to respond. Understand that Israel, you know, is a sort of Lockean social contract. The people of Israel will pay our exorbitant taxes. We will serve in the army. We will fight in the wars. If the government proves to us that those wars are justified, that the government represents our values. The government is also pulling its weight. And there are many ministers in this government who haven't served in the army for various reasons. Some of them are ultra-Orthodox and don't serve in the army. Some of them were so radical right-wingers that the army wouldn't even let them serve. They're considered racist. Hello, what, I'm gonna pay 55% of my income to this government, to all these people who are not working. I'm gonna go out and risk my life or my children's lives for a person who's never worn a uniform or carried a gun, refuses to. That social contract can begin to unravel. That's never happened. And this country's been under extraordinary pressures since the day of its birth in 1948. We've never had a situation where, you know, we threw a war and nobody came. The poster of the 60s. Well, what happened to people threw a war and nobody came? Well, we've thrown a whole bunch of wars and people always came. And every war we've had, the number of reservists reporting for duty has always exceeded 100%, which is quite amazing. I don't know how you exceed 100%. It's people who aren't on the roll, aren't on the rosters anymore, show up. So when reservists are saying now in advance, if there's a war, we're not going to show up. That is a totally unprecedented development in this country, totally unprecedented and very terrifying. It's showing that the social contract, the fabric, is unraveling.
Yeah, I think this is an absolutely key point. I think many people understand why the social contract, you know, subjectively may feel broken for the ultra-Orthodox or the settlers, so to speak, but isn't, in a sense, what's different here and maybe genuinely alarming is that the majority of Israeli society, that kind of big middle tent, they're starting to question their own kind of civic identity, their place in Israel, and whether Israel reflects who they are and their more secular values, their, as you say, openness towards LGBT rights, which Israel has really been a world leader on. And you can go through so many different, you know them all, Michael, but so many different indicators where there is a positive kind of progressive spirit in Israeli society. Is that, Michael, what's really part of this crisis? Is a crisis of identity of the soft majority that underwrites your military, your civic infrastructure, your political institutions? Is that what's really at play?
Yeah, I don't want to put in terms of majority and minority, because the numbers are sometimes very confusing. But there are definitely two Israels here, which are clashing, tectonically clashing. There's the Israel that wants Israel to be, as you described it, an open and very liberal society that is a leader in the arts and culture, certainly in innovation and science, the world-class universities, the Philharmonic, everything you know about Israel that's world-class, that has the great restaurants. You know, you have culinary tours of Israel now, and beaches, and wants to be something like a normal country, wants to be Sweden. I don't want to say France, because France is not so normal anymore. It wants to be Sweden. But you have another country, another part of Israel that says, you know, the Jewish people were never supposed to be normal. In the Bible, that's God's message to Abraham. You're about to be abnormal. And why, once we have a state, would we ever want that state to be normal? We want it to be a Jewish state. And we care more about that Jewish state than we do about having good food in restaurants or, you know, having nice promenades along the beach. That's not important to us, as it is, you know, tradition and the integrity of the land of Israel, which includes, you know, Judea and Samaria, the West Bank. You have these two Israels, and very generally, it breaks down along ethnic lines. It breaks along between secular and religious lines. Though you have, you know, secular people in the nationalist camp, you have religious people in the normative camp. But these are the two Israels that are literally grinding up against one another here. I think the reform issue is very substantive and profound. It also serves as type of a metaphor for this cultural tectonic clash.
If you were to hypothesize about where we find Israel at its centenary, having gone through this upheaval in the second decade of the 21st century, how does this reverberate? I mean, I look at these large protests and you think there's a potential here for an immense agglomeration of civic energy that could be incredibly positive, maybe for some of those more progressive, and I don't mean in a political way, I just mean in a 21st century being part of the rest of the world kind of way. I mean, are we actually... Maybe it's that cliche of it's darkest before the dawn, and you are undergoing right now a transformation of Israeli society that will have reverberations again for decades to come.
That was actually beautifully put. I agree with you. Yeah, you can't, first of all, spend much time in this country, and I have, is not be an optimist, but you can't be an historian and not be an optimist. And what I bring to the book, The Rejuvenated State, 2048, is the historical perspective. And that is, you know, this country was founded 75 years ago. It was nothing. There were 600,000 Jews in the country, no natural resources, no allies, surrounded by adversaries. We created that democracy. And Israel's one of, along with Canada, the United States, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, is one of the few countries in the world that's never known a second of non-democratic governance. And we've never known a second of peace, which is, we're the only country on the list like that. So that's quite extraordinary. We developed an army which would become more than twice as large as the British and French armies combined. It's a citizens' army. seven world-class universities, you know, the whole innovation, the revival of the Hebrew language. You know, more people speak Hebrew today than speak Danish and Finnish, and amazing. This is a language that wasn't spoken, you know, 150 years ago. And you have, you know, people winning Nobel Prizes and Booker Prizes, you know, in Hebrew. It's not to be taken for granted. And it's a beautiful country. It's a beautiful country which has more land under conservation per capita than just about any country in the world. Very, very beautiful country. Really, it has many, many, many accomplishments to it. And then I've been here, oh boy, 45 years, and I've seen, you know, a million Soviet Jews in the former Soviet Union come here, tens of thousands of Ethiopian Jews. I've seen this country transformed. I've seen peace with Egypt, peace with Jordan, peace now with four other Arab countries, the Abraham Accords. When I came here, we did not have relations with China, India, almost all of Africa. The Soviet satellite countries, nothing with South America, and a nice relationship with the United States. We now have great relations with just about everybody, and we have a deep and multifaceted strategic alliance with the United States. This is in my lifetime. This is, you know, these things that could take place over the hundreds of years that take place since I've been here. And yet, that's not what this book is about. The book is about the issues that may jeopardize our ability to have a second century as successful as our first. And that includes the Palestinian issue, of course. The largest chapter in the book is about the Palestinians. And I've been involved in every peace initiative pretty much since the Oslo Accords. I was an advisor to Yitzhak Rabin, going back 30 years this year. And the ultra-Orthodox issue, which is an existential issue. If we don't resolve the Orthodox issue, this country will not be sustainable in 40, 50 years, because the population is growing so fast, and ultra-Orthodox children get an education that's roughly that of a second grader in Canada. So the country simply won't be sustainable. Never mind defensible, it won't be sustainable. There are issues with Bedouin in the south, which are acute. Our relationship with the Israeli Arab population, the 21%, and our foreign relations with the United States, with Europe, with Canada, other Western countries. All of these have to be addressed now, or we will not have the second century. And if there's anything, I'm not a prophet, really not. I'm a historian, and I've got enough problems predicting the past. But the fact that I wrote the chapter on the need to reform the Supreme Court 3 years ago, and now this has exploded, can show you that you're never premature, you're never too early in pointing out the issues that could jeopardize the future security, prosperity, and even survival of this country. And it's not too early. And that's why I wrote this book. It, strangely enough, it began in a conversation between myself and Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu when I was the deputy to the prime minister. And I walked into Bibi one day and I said, you know something? We're so bogged down in our current crises, we never have time to think about the future. Let's create a project where we imagine Israel on its 100th birthday. And you know what he said? He says, great, go for it. And look, we shall see.
You cannot make this up. As someone who's just so much enjoyed your writing over the years, just a pleasure and honor to connect with you today at just such an important moment in Israel. You've expanded my mind. You've elucidated, I think, so many of the key factors and ideas that we should be thinking about, both not just in terms of this crisis, but the future of Israel, which is so important to so many Canadians and people around the world. So thank you for your public service. Thank you for your writing and your creativity and your leadership. And again, a real privilege to have you on the Monk Dialogues today.
Thank you. Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
Well, that wraps up our dialogue today. I want to urge you to check out Michael Oren's amazing books that he's published over the years on Israeli history, the Middle East. This is a guy you want to be reading. You want to have his books on your bookshelf. If you have feedback or reflections on what you've just heard or any of our other podcasts, please send us an email to podcast@monkdebates.com. That's M-U-N-K, debates with an S, .com. Also, a friendly reminder that you can catch our weekly current affairs podcast, Friday Focus, each and every Friday here on this podcast feed or on our website, www.monkdebates.com. Just click on the top right navigation where it says Friday Focus, and it'll take you to the latest version, the latest episode in this regular Monk program. Thank you for spending some time with us, lending your attention to our efforts to restore the art of public conversation, one dialogue at a time. I'm your host and moderator, Rudyard Griffiths. The Monk Debates are a project of the Aurea and Peter and Melanie Monk Charitable Foundations. Rudyard Griffiths and Ricky Gerwitz are the producers. Be sure to download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like us, feel free to give us a 5-star rating. Thank you again for listening.